Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. I used to watch my three teenage nephews eat big family dinners. Then as they did the dishes, they'd polish off the hefty leftovers. And an hour later, they headed out for burgers. That trio made the great white shark look like it was doing a cleanse. Well, this is the world of Lucinda Scala Quinn. She's got three sons and a husband. All love to eat a lot and often. Lucinda, good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn. Boy, you describe it so well.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't have kids of my own, but I've never forgotten those three kids. It was like nonstop.
Yeah, it's an urgent situation.
So is there really a difference between feeding boys and men and feeding women?
In some ways, yes, in some ways, no, Lynn. I maintain that once you have more than one hungry male, you have you're on the way to an emergency. And I find that females are a little different, although we do share a lot in common, of course. But, for example, us females will eat salads that are mediocre salads because we think we need to eat salads. But
right,
a guy's
right.
not eating a salad unless it's a darn good salad. So, yeah, there are a few differences. I really think there are. But overall, we all, you know, I just want everybody to get to the table and eat good, healthy food, really.
Yeah, I must say, I mean, from the way you write and what I've seen personally, it seems that boys are like baby birds. They have to eat seven times their weight every day. And, they just go at it. Now, you happen to have this career in food. Why don't you explain to everybody what you do?
Yeah, so I'm the food director for Martha Stewart Living Omnimedia, which basically means sort of overviewing the food that comes out of our company in all its different ways, books, magazines, so forth, in collaboration with Martha, of course. So that's my day job.
See, now, I think that's cheating a bit, because I also understand that you've been a chef. You do food on the radio. I mean, you're a step ahead of everybody, right?
Well, one could say that. But the thing is, okay, 6 o'clock in the morning, the dog's barking needs to go out. The three kids need to get out the door. You're tired. You're late. I'm in the same boat, Lynn, as half the women I know. That's really true. It's not like I'm whipping up a gourmet meal or making a wedding cake. I'm just basically trying to get some healthy food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the only thing possibly year after year after year of working in food is I've noticed and culled perhaps some techniques and strategies that I am able to employ in my real life. And hopefully some of those things, give me the advantage or at least a reason to be able to write a book that people would actually think is credible.
What you're talking about is you've got people in your house who eat 24/7 practically. How do you keep food on hand for that?
Oh, well, yeah. And it's just like you said, you finish the dinner, you're cleaning up, someone else has arrived, they're hungry. You know, maybe you want to do it. It's just insane. It's like an oncoming train at all times. So for me, 50% of dealing with that is really shopping. And when I say shopping, I really say kind of identify what your set of circumstances are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it fudge? Is it budget? Is it health? Is it space? Is it location in terms of the market? Figure that out first. That's number one. And number two, shop strategically. Pick a day. I like to pick a day. For me, it's Sunday morning here in New York City, 8 o'clock in the morning. I go up to one of our big supermarkets and I do a reasonable weekly shop with a budget in mind. And in my head, I have a general plan of like three meals that will have meat and maybe, two more that won't. And then I can usually riff the next 2 days.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
You know what I mean? So I know, for example, and I'll often go and see what's on special or what looks good. I'll maybe get, 2 pounds of stew meat, a couple of chickens, and maybe pork chops. Let's just say I start with that,
mm-hmm.
round it out with some vegetables and grains, and then the real, the other stuff you need. And I'll get vegetables maybe for a day or two. And in my head, by the time I've gotten home, I have a sense of what a couple straightforward meals could be. And while I'm unpacking, I'll maybe either make a little bit of something or prep a little something, or at the very least jot down my ideas for three meals, which literally, Lynn, is like roast chicken, broccoli, potato. It's not like fancy.
So what is it like for you being surrounded by men?
Oh,
especially
gosh.
In the
most
kitchen.
Most of the time, it's awesome. I honestly, in all seriousness, what you see is what you get. You know, they break lamps, they trip over things, they leave their big shoes around. But there's no pretense, in my view, about being around a lot of men. It's less head and more heart, and it's just out there. A lot of passion. And you know what? They're so happy when you feed them. And that's one of the most gratifying things there is.
Lucinda, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Lucinda Scala-Quinn is author of Mad Hungry, Feeding Men and Boys. Now, her day job is executive editorial director of food and entertaining for Martha Stewart OmniMedia. You can find her recipe for the fundamental man food, crunchy sesame chicken wings, on our website, splendidtable.org. And while checking out the site, take a look at our Cheap Eats recipe collection, our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and maybe try a podcast or two. It's all there. SplendidTable.org. Has been welcomed at last in the academic world of social history. Now consider this topic, crime and nourishment. Now this has to be one of the catchier titles for a doctoral dissertation. And by the way, the subtitle is The Food and Foodways of Hollywood Gangster Films. Its creator, Rebecca Epstein, now is a doctor of philosophy in film and television. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you.
Rebecca, I'm just thinking about all the ways that food plays in film. You never think of food in gangster films. I mean, why gangster films?
Well, it's interesting when I often hear that. And when you think about it for a minute, suddenly scenes start coming to mind, particularly with Italian mafia films. People do have those associations with food in film.
Yeah, that's right. I remember from very old movies, the James Cagney scene. I think it was a movie from the 30s, and he plays a gangster, and he shoves a half a grapefruit in the face of his girlfriend, and it still makes me squirm anytime I see it.
Yes, and you know that film, that scene was actually improvised, which is part of the reason she looks so shocked.
Right.
But it started for me, I actually took an informal poll in one of my graduate classes of the students in my class and asked them what for them were some of their most memorable food scenes in film. And to my surprise, about 80% of the class came back with scenes from Pulp Fiction.
Huh.
And now this was back in 95. That film came out in 93, so it wasn't too far away from that point.
Right, right.
But what I realized is that I hadn't thought about all those scenes. I knew the film began and ended at a diner, and I was as charmed as anybody by the Big Mac dialogue and all of that, but it hadn't occurred to me exactly how rich with food that film was. So I began by studying that film and looking at the different ways food was used, and then I started to think, well, what about in other gangster films? And so much had been written about the gangster film in film scholarship, but nobody had really written about the way food was used, both structurally and thematically. So that became my project.
I always think of food in a gangster movie. I mean, if you think about it, you think of it as sort of an aside, that it's not really important to the plot. So this is like putting on a different set of glasses to look at it.
Exactly. It's about bringing the background forward. And it actually speaks to a film in general. You know, we're used to thinking about the food film with food as the star of the
show.
Right,
right.
But in this case, my argument was you can't actually really understand this genre unless you look at the way food is used. And one of the things I found that was most profound structurally is that there's a constant alternation between food scenes and violent scenes. It's not in every single gangster film, but it's enough to feel like there's something going on here that's impacting the way that we are experiencing these films. There is a tension that is constantly being provoked within us in this constant alternation between food scenes where people are gathering together, eating, enjoying each other's company, and then, bam, somebody's dying. Hence all these murder scenes in restaurants. And, you know, we're caught by surprise every time.
Some specific films that you think would really be interesting to look at through that prism?
Well, one of them is that film you mentioned, Public Enemy, starring James Cagney. You know, that's one of the main films in my study, because one thing that has been identified in the gangster film is the persistent imagery of misogyny. And as I began my study, I realized there are actually numerous gangster films where men are throwing food at women. So food becomes a way to express misogyny, which has already been identified as one of the elements of the gangster genre.
Right, right.
So that's one. Another one is Bonnie and Clyde, where I talk about food and sex. And in that film, Clyde is, you know, known for his impotence. And one of the ways he sublimates that is through a constant, he just constantly eats dairy products. There's constant references to peaches and pies, and I'm sure I don't have to explain to your audience ways that those foods have come to represent, you know, certain parts of the female body.
Right.
At the same time, Bonnie is very much a masculine presence in that film, and she eats a lot of meat. She's constantly eating hamburgers, and there's just an interesting way of looking at these characters through the food that they eat.
This is pretty fascinating. Well, let's get specific about Pulp Fiction.
Well, one of the interesting things about that film is the men in that film are constantly eating the food that children tend to eat. They're eating Pop-Tarts, cereal. In one scene, these young men are eating hamburgers for breakfast. And you just get the sense that these are not grown-up men. These are men who are trying to find their way, and they're feeling their most comfortable eating foods that are familiar to them, but maybe not necessarily appropriate for their age or that time of day. And that's one of the things that also throws us off balance in that film. We never quite know what time it is, because their food doesn't really sync up with the associations we have with what you eat at what meal.
And also, the food that sounds like the food of innocence.
Absolutely.
Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Epstein is Doctor of Philosophy in Film and Television. Her dissertation was Crime and Nourishment, The Food and Foodways of Hollywood Gangster Films. So why not do a marathon of food movies? Public Enemy, Bonnie and Clyde, and Pulp Fiction. And then you could cater it with burgers, Pop-Tarts, and grapefruit halves. And then for those who are gluttons for punishment, you could go to the dark side. The movies would be Delicatessen, that fascinating short called Lemon, and for the big finale, The Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Coming up, potstickers, samosas, and bao, the dumplings of Asia, burnt offerings with the Stearns, and Stump the Cook. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Are universal. I mean, you can call them creplock, you can call them ravioli, potstickers, samosa, bushy-bushy, empanada, dim sum, all come out of the same idea, some kind of dough wrapped around a filling. I mean, we love anything that you wrap in a dough, and the dumpling is the greatest economy food. I mean, with a handful of whatever you've got on hand, you can feed a passel of people. Now, while I grew up sealing ravioli, Andrea Nguyen was folding wonton. Now, in her latest book, Andrea takes on the most complicated dumpling territory on the planet. She's written Asian Dumplings, Mastering Gyoza, Spring Rolls, Samosas, and more. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Are you nuts? I mean, this is... Now, you have taken on so many traditions. I mean, you're covering everything from what, Korea to India?
Why not, Lynn? Why not? I mean, I think that you can tour through Asia by eating and making dumplings. And the book is developed so that the chapters are organized by dough types. So the first half of the book is really about what you can do with basic wheat flour. And we're talking wheat flour you get at your regular supermarket, not the fancy high-gluten stuff that you use for rustic, chewy breads. Okay?
Right,
we're talking regular flour.
So what else can you make dumplings out of?
You can make dumplings out of practically anything. So maybe legumes, such as garbanzo flour, for example, and potato tubers, taro. You actually form doughs out of those kinds of starchy ingredients or batters. And you can also make dumplings out of rice, ground up rice into flours or maybe batters that you then steam into rice sheets that then you can fill up and then cook into these wonderful dim sum favorites.
All right, so to do it ourselves, what do we need to know? What are the basics that we need to know to do our own dumplings?
You need to realize that it's not a perfectionist kind of game. I think a lot of people fear making Asian dumplings because they think that everything needs to look perfect and dainty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've eaten dumplings from all over the world, and most oftentimes they're just kind of these very handcrafted, doughy morsels that have a certain rusticity about them. And if you just get the darn wrapper closed, that's all that you need to do. Work on your technique and the way that the dumpling looks as you go along mastering and refining your techniques.
That's a lovely word, rusticity. This gives me a lot of leeway. But you've raised a good question. This business about sealing the dough, are there tricks to make sure? Because they always open up. A lot of people have this problem.
You know what? If people were to try to make their own dumpling wrappers from freshly made dough, there is no problem with sealing it because the dough is very moist and you don't have to wet the wrappers. You just press them closed because they are very moist and the wrappers are also very forgiving. Even if you have a little tear, you can kind of patch it up. Start out with a simple half moon shape. And, you know, that's just a circle with a filling in the center, folded in half, and then press real tightly just so that you practically meld the two edges together. And you're done. Kids can do this. Older people can do it. People aged in between can do it.
But what about those wonton wrappers they sell at the store? How do you seal those?
You know, you just need to brush a little water on those and press really firmly. Make sure that after you brush on the water that the skin has kind of softened a little bit. Sometimes the skins that you purchase at the store are very dry because they're kind of old.
Yeah.
You know, try to buy your skins at an Asian market or a place that has a quick turnaround. I think that what I'd like to see people do is to use a store-bought, then make the homemade wrappers or in reverse, and then compare the two experiences. And people will find that the homemade wrappers are actually quite easy to prepare. You can make the dough ahead of time several days and keep it refrigerated.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing with the filling, and then bring it together at a dumpling party. Don't do it yourself. Have people join in to help you so that it's less of a intense, intimidating process. And have fun with it. Don't try to aim for the perfect dumpling the first time around.
Right. Let's talk fillings, because that's when I think the fun really starts. What are some of the possibilities for fillings?
The possibilities, Lynn, are endless because you can use different kinds of meat. You know, in many parts of Asia, particularly East Asia, pork is the meat. When you say meat, it means pork.
Right.
But you can use chicken, you can use beef, lamb, pressed tofu, which is a wonderful, wonderful ingredient, and even fresh cheeses, similar to like paneer, and different kinds of vegetables, so that you get flavor and texture and just a lot of well-rounded seasonings as well. You always want to make the filling a little bit more heavily seasoned than you want to, because the dough itself is not that well-seasoned. So you kind of depend on the filling to extend its flavor into the dough. And then, of course, there are dipping sauces, too.
Oh, yeah. So, Andrea, give me a starter dumpling, a dumpling where, you know, if we've never done it before, this is the place to begin.
You know, one of my favorite dumplings in the cookbook is a simple fish and Chinese chive dumpling. The reason being is that if you love steamed fish, this little dumpling is like having steamed fish encased in a little tender piece of dough, and it's absolutely delicious. So what I would do is make the basic dumpling dough out of unbleached flour and water. Do it in your food processor. Make it a day ahead if you'd like. And then make the filling in advance. And you can use whatever different kinds of basic mild tasting fish, such as sole or cod, which is very easy to find. And then there's just a little salt, white pepper, and a little dry sherry, or if you've got the Chinese rice wine, add that in there. And then a little ginger, and you can use Chinese chives, which are the sort of the flat chives that taste have like a mild garlic taste. Or if you don't have that, use scallion. Put it all together. Mm-hmm. Again, that filling is mostly made in the food processor. Have the filling ready to go. Have the dough ready to go. Roll out your wrappers. Seal up the filling. And then you can steam them just like you would, you know, a steamed fish, essentially. Or if you'd like, pan fry them or poach them. And that's basically it. Very straightforward.
This is great. Hey, Andrea, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Andrea Nguyen's latest book is Asian Dumplings, Mastering Gyoza, Spring Rolls, Samosas, and More. Now, you can find the ideal dumpling starter recipe, her fish and Chinese chive dumplings, on the website, splendidtable.org. Maybe you've seen what I've noticed lately. All kinds of Asian restaurants are offering Chinese dim sum in parts of the country where dim sum is not necessarily a tradition. Now, it takes serious skill to do dim sum. You need special cooks to do this. I mean, hang out in a busy Chinese community on Saturday morning and you'll see what I mean. The restaurants with steam windows, well, that's where the dim sum is being made, fresh and by hand. Now, the reason that those restaurants that are outside of dim sum territory are serving those dumplings is the freezer case, because dumplings freeze really well. And by the way, they're irresistible to kids. Now, I'm not saying that your freezer case is going to put a great dim sum chef out of business, but they sure work on a Wednesday night. In this business of tracking down good local eats, you have got to kiss an awful lot of frogs before you get a prince. But Jane and Michael Stern nail it all the time. They just sniff out the right places. Now, the best part is that they check in with us regularly and they report in to their website, roadfood.com. Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
So where have the wanderings taken you recently?
We've spent a lot of time in South Louisiana, and one of the great things to eat in South Louisiana is that strange confluence of three cuisines, Italian, Cajun, and Southern. And many restaurants sort of combine them all into this fabulous kind of indefinable menu. And the best of them all, in my opinion, is one called Rocky and Carlos out in Chalmette, which is in St. Bernard Parish, you know, east of the city. It was one of those places devastated by Hurricane Katrina and is kind of slowly coming back. One of the places that once was underwater but is now back and thriving is Rocky and Carlos. And it's, as I said, the cuisine is this, I mean, it's Cajun. It's got a like a real strong dose of Italian spice and brio, and it's got that kind of Dixie comfort food as well. So, I mean, when you walk through the cafeteria line, you can choose from among pork chops with greens, veal parmesan, stuffed peppers, muffalettas, fried shrimp, oysters, baked chicken, and what I believe is the best seafood gumbo anywhere, including in New Orleans.
And I would say the best macaroni and cheese that ever walked the earth, although macaroni and cheese does not walk. But should it decide to walk, it would be the best.
What makes it so special?
Well, it's very different than what we think of as typical macaroni and cheese. First of all, it's not made with elbow noodles. It's instead made from very substantial, like, percatelli tubes, like longer things, you know, with and kind of thicker, where the pasta is more of a presence. And what's great about it, and this is sort of the signature dish of Rocky and Carlos, is that every portion served is a great combination of, like, creamy, cheesy stuff from the middle, kind of chewy stuff from the top, and very brittle, crusty stuff from the edge. So you get the full spectrum of what macaroni and cheese can be. And best of all, I mean, it's great as it is, but best of all, you can have it with either marinara sauce on top or the same delicious brown gravy that they use for their roast beef po' boy.
Uh-oh. I just realized we're talking to Lynn Rossetto Casper, who's like the foremost authority on Italian food, and we're talking about
macaroni and cheese
with brown gravy.
No. But I
you will not
say,
find this in the old country, I'm pretty sure.
Don't speak so fast.
You know, the bottom line is it tastes delicious, and I think we'd all agree on that.
No, what as I was, you were describing it, what occurred to me was, this is what has been missing from mac and cheese.
Well, that's true.
We had it all three ways, plain and with each of the sauces. And every one, it's like a completely different dish.
So this place, is this like a big place where you go down the line?
It is.
A cafeteria.
It's a great big kind of eating hall and tavern. You know, all the great restaurants in Louisiana have served liquor. But it's a great big kind of eating hall. And you go through the line. Many dishes are plated and given to you right there. Some dishes, like an oyster po' boy, for example. Oh, boy, and that's a good one. That you order it, and they fry up the oysters while you get to your table. And pretty within a few minutes of you sitting down at the table, out comes your hot oyster po' boy with the oysters still too hot to eat.
Huh. This sounds awfully good.
It's the best.
It is delicious.
It's great.
Guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, every week you can hear them here, but you can get their latest finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. It's time to turn to you and your questions. You can find us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is waiting patiently. We have got Anne on the line calling from Baltimore. Anne, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about home fries or hash browns.
Ooh. Yeah. So what's to talk about? They're great.
Well, I guess I don't know how to prepare them properly. I am a newlywed, and on my way back from my honeymoon, we got stranded in the Atlanta airport and ate at one of those airport restaurants.
Right.
They had the best home fries, and it was that down-home taste that I've been trying to replicate.
Right.
And
right.
So they weren't greasy. They weren't undercooked or overcooked. Uh-huh. And it was just right, and it was seasoned just right. It wasn't too salty. Well, and I can't figure out how to
get that.
Yes.
Okay. Describe them to me. Were they the shredded kind?
No, it wasn't the shredded kind. It was the chopped potato.
And was there sweet peppers in it and onions as well?
Onions, as far as I can tell, but not necessarily sweet peppers, or at least I didn't see.
Right. And were they kind of brown and crispy?
Yes.
That's the key. Now, this is the thing. First of all, great hash browns are generally made from boiling potatoes.
Boiling potatoes?
Yeah, not baking potatoes. Baking potatoes are very fluffy. Boiling potatoes tend to be firmer and waxier. Mm-hmm. So those red skin potatoes you see in the market would be a good place to start.
Okay.
Secondly, they're pre-cooked. And that may be the key for you.
Pre-cooked?
Yeah. Usually what they are is they're boiled. So that they're almost completely cooked. They're not falling apart. You know, they're still somewhat firm. So if you simmer those potatoes in cold water, any kind of water, to cover, okay? Don't peel them yet. Just simmer them to cover.
You mean whole?
Whole, yeah. Okay. And if you start out with small ones, it's just easier to work with them. But the point is, larger or smaller, you want to cook them until when you pierce them with a knife to their center, you get a bit of resistance.
Uh-huh.
You drain them. You rinse them with cold water. Let them cool down completely to room temperature, okay?
Okay.
And then cut them into the shapes that you remember those potatoes being. Mm-hmm. And then what you do is you do a good film of oil in the pan. Now, some people use a little bacon fat with that if you want a bacony flavor. Mm-hmm. All right? But you don't necessarily have to.
Yeah, generally I'm using olive oil.
That's going to be utterly delicious. And what I would do is get that fairly hot. It's going to look almost wavy mm-hmm. in the pan, okay? And then throw in those potatoes with salt and pepper and let them cook. Just let them sit there.
So not quite frying, but are
you? You're frying them.
Oh, you are frying.
You're frying them, but they're okay. in chunks, mm-hmm. you see.
Okay.
And you're kind of almost pressing them in the pan. Uh-huh. And use a spatula so you can kind of slip under them and flip them over. Mm-hmm. Now, you could add also some chopped onion with them as well. Mm-hmm. And then what you do is you let them cook. Don't disturb them. Let them get crusty. Kind of on one side. And then you kind of flip them around and you press them in gently again and let them get crusty again. Because if you think about this, this dish began as using leftover potatoes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's the idea. Pre-cook them first. And by the way, if you had those potatoes in the refrigerator overnight, it wouldn't hurt a bit.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the key.
So as far as the oil, you're saying to let it get really hot?
You want to get them over medium-high heat and give it a minute or two to heat up. And okay. you want a big, shallow, heavy-bottomed, you know, like a straight-sided
cast
sauté.
Iron.
Cast iron would be utterly perfect.
Uh-huh.
I can't think of anything better.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you can throw onion in there. Later on, you could add a little garlic. You always want to be careful with garlic because if garlic burns, it gets bitter.
Right.
But you can put minced garlic in, you know, toward the end of cooking. But since your potatoes are already cooked, all you're doing now is getting that nice brown crustiness, which gives them great flavor.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You are welcome. And my mouth is watering at the thought of what you're going to be eating.
It's been a pleasure.
Hey, and you enjoy.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, hash brown potatoes. Give me a break. 800-537-5252. They're so easy. That's the problem. I eat too many of them. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or send us an email at contact@splendidtable.org. Okay, it is time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week the question is, where does the expression high on the hog come from? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and we're going to be taking more of your calls, 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or get to us online via splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, where does the expression high on the hog come from? Well, high on the hog is where the money is. The priciest part of the pig. I mean, if you could afford pork chops and rib roast and pork steaks, your ship had come in. You were in the money. The expression is associated with the Depression of the 1930s, but I think that goes back a lot further. When farmers and townspeople lived closer and mingled more, everybody knew their food, well, sort of from the ground up. For instance, the best meat for stewing is the meat closest to the ground, as in the shank or the leg of beef or lamb or veal or pork. Now, there's this dead giveaway you can see if you're looking for great braising and stewing cuts. The meat will have curls of light-colored connective tissue instead of waves or dashes of fat. Those curls melt in slow cooking into the most delicious silky juices. Now, there's a lot to be said about making a great stew, but the most important thing is to get the right cut of meat. Look for beef shank meat with its bones, which, by the way, are filled with delicious marrow. Now, the most important trick is never let the cooking liquid boil. I mean, never, ever. You want the occasional bloop of bubble breaking the surface, but nothing more. That is the secret of a great stew or braise. Okay, now back to talking to you. Call us, 800-537-5252, or email from the website, splendidtable.org. Let's see, we have got Ramesh calling from Lincoln, Nebraska. Ramesh, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. My question is about cumin and coriander, and specifically cumin and coriander in spice rubs for fish. Mm-hmm. I usually have used it in Thai food that I make, but I try, and I love the taste of them so much,
right.
I'd like to kind of expand their usage in my culinary repertoire, I guess. So I thought fish would be a great place to go.
Oh, it is a great place to go. I have to tell you, I must go through a sizable bag of each one of those spices every year. Because this is the reason why. They carry over Thai, much of the cuisines of India.
Oh, right. Growing up, I got a lot of cumin and coriander from my mother cooking.
Your family is from India?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Then you have it in your genetic structure.
I do. I'm predisposed to liking cumin and coriander, I guess.
But it can take you so many places. I mean, you know, all of the Arab world. Certainly, I mean, cumin and coriander, for goodness sakes, can take you into Scandinavia, all over, you know, Latin America. And yes, it works wonderfully with fish. One of the things, though, that I like to do with it, because especially with the coriander seed, it always reminds me of oranges. And I have a penchant for orange zest in things, but I like the idea of mixing those two spices with orange zest and maybe even a little bit of orange pulp with, you know, with some olive oil and with a little bit of garlic. And you rub that into a fish or into poultry, into almost anything. It's wonderful on lamb as well.
Okay. All right.
But that would work on a fish. And that would
That would be great. Is there any particular type of fish that would work better on, like a whitefish or a assuming salmon, probably not, right?
Well, no. Salmon, probably yes. Because the robust fish, like salmon, like mackerel, like bluefish, which you don't see very often, but the idea of fish that has a good deal of natural oils in it that give it a more robust flavor, that's going to stand up beautifully to those flavors. They'll work equally well with more delicate fish. But yeah, this would be really delicious with a salmon, believe it or not.
Okay, so some cumin, some coriander, and some orange pulp and zest.
And
zest
with a bit of olive oil. Let the olive oil be there. It's a carrier of flavor. And the other thing about it is that it's just going to help that rub adhere and keep the, you know, the rub moistening the fish.
Right. Okay, great. That sounds wonderful. I'll try that this weekend, probably.
You know what? I think you're going to enjoy it.
All right. Thanks so much, Lynn.
Hey, you are welcome.
Keep doing a great job on the show.
Hey, thank you.
Bye.
You can send us an email, splendidtable.org, or you can call us on the phone, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up next? We've got Ted calling from Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Ted, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about a piece of meat to barbecue for about 60 people that wouldn't be real expensive.
Ah, okay.
And I'll tell you a little background.
Sure.
We inherited an apple press about 25 years ago, and we started doing an annual apple pressing party. And it started out with just a few friends and neighbors, and it has continued to grow. And now it's children, grandchildren, and it's looking at our list for this year, it's about 60 people.
This is fabulous. So you're making cider.
Yes. And everybody brings a wonderful fall dish to share. So
this sounds fabulous. Okay, so we're talking how to give them a protein for not a ton of money.
Right.
And you want to be able to grill it, right?
Right. And what I've done, it started out with a mixed grill and then went to albacore tuna, then a turkey. In the last 4 years, I've done a spiral cut ham, two of them, and just slowly smoke it over mountain mahogany wood.
Oh, this sounds absolutely fabulous. Well, poultry, you know, can be a lifesaver. And I have to say, I mean, I have a penchant for chicken wings. I love chicken wings. I love eating them with my fingers. I love slow grilling them. You can marinate them for a couple of days. But if you don't want to go that route, you know, there's the shoulder of pork is one of the most delicious, succulent cuts of meat. I would take that over a loin of pork any day. And it can be extremely reasonable. And one of the things that you can do with it is that you can essentially butterfly it, so you don't have to cook it, you know, for 9 hours. And you can marinate it, and it can be utterly fabulous. And depending on where you buy it, what your source is, it can be as little as $2.50 a pound, maybe.
Okay.
So that's one way to think about going. And what's great about it is it doesn't have, I mean, you can get it boneless, but even if you have a bone in it, you know, you can carve a lot of boneless pieces of meat that people can eat very easily.
How many pounds would that?
Well, if everybody is, they have 60 people, everybody's bringing something, right? Is yours going to be the only meat or protein?
There'll probably be some other, but it's the main.
It's the main. Then I would figure about 6 to 7 ounces a person if it's boneless. Maybe play it safe and say 8 ounces if it's boneless. Mm-hmm. If the bone in, I would add another ounce or two. Because there's, again, it's not like there's a ton of bones in a shoulder of pork. And you could buy several of these roasts boneless, and they're referred to as shoulder if they come from one part of the shoulder. They're referred to as butt if they come from another part.
Right.
But this is always one of the most flavorful parts of any animal. And then when you get that roast, which is usually tied together, you know, but it's a hunk of meat, cut it halfway through and open it up like a book.
Okay.
And then pierce it, and you can put any kind of seasoning that you like in this. I think if you want to go more or less Mediterranean or Italian, fresh rosemary, garlic, olive oil, a little wine, let it sit overnight with that. If you want to be more exotic, you could use all kinds of chilies, citrus fruit, ginger, you know, garlic, a bit of fish sauce, and slow grill. Use indirect grilling, you know, where the fire's off to one side. Have a drip pan, and you can do 3 or 4 of these roasts. They'll be easy to carve. You can cut them into small pieces. The fat gets crusty and delicious.
Yum.
And the other thing, the only other thing for me personally is I adore chicken, and I can butterfly them or cut them up or just do chicken thighs. And chicken thighs are fabulous because they're the most forgiving piece of meat. You can't overcook the blessed things.
That's right. That's
you know, good. And they are even less expensive than pork. And anything you can do with pork, you can do with a chicken thigh. And if you think about it, they're really easy to manage for people. You can buy them boneless, but save money. Buy them on the bone because they're so easy to eat. It's like eating corn on the cob.
Right.
So that's one other thing to think about.
And, all right.
And they'll cook a little bit faster, too.
Yes.
So thighs or shoulder?
All right.
And you're off and running.
All right.
Hey, have a wonderful party. It sounds like a great tradition.
It is.
Hey,
Ted.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you for a great call. Bye.
Right. Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. Time to play Stump the Cook, our refrigerator game. And we have our celebrity stump master, Mr. Christopher Kimball from America's Test Kitchen and Cooks Illustrated Magazine. Chris, why don't you explain the rules of the game?
Rules of the game are there are 5 ingredients in the fridge that you have to use. Lynn gets free water, salt and pepper, and some sort of oil or fat, plus up to 3 additional ingredients that our contestant actually has in their kitchen.
And the idea is that you tell me what's in your fridge and I'm supposed to make a dish that you...
That I think is actually worth eating.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes. And
so
also
it's a, that's a high hurdle.
Okay. So who's our caller?
Aaliyah's our caller. Aaliyah, where are you calling from?
Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
Hey, that's my old hometown.
Oh, really? What neighborhood?
Park Slope.
That's where I live.
You're kidding.
No.
Are you in Lynn's old apartment?
That would be really creepy.
That would be very creepy. Best kitchen I ever had. It was designed for me, and it was 12 feet by 6 feet, and I started a catering business out
of
it.
Oh, wow.
You never had to move. You just turn a circle.
Yes, that's right. You're that's right. Set. It was amazing. Anyway, so what's in the refrigerator?
What's in the refrigerator?
Okay, this is my list. And these are all things I often have, so you'll be doing me a big favor by telling me what to do with them.
Okay.
Okay. Two leeks. Mm-hmm. Some nice bacon, mm-hmm. eggs, a nice block of New York State Colby cheese, and homemade chicken stock.
Oh, this is easy.
You are the nicest person. There's no blueberry sauce and foie gras.
This is gorgeous.
This is excellent.
I love this.
I think Lynn's going to win this one.
I think she is, but you know what? She's going to have a lot of fun in the process. Okay, here's what I'd like to do then. I'd like to have some carrot.
Okay.
Three ingredients. Do you have carrots?
Okay, this is my vegetable situation. There are always vegetables, but sometimes they're a little sad. So they're definitely carrots. Oh. They're not like the most...
We're not asking for the beauty queens here. We're fine. Okay, so you've got carrots, right? Have you got celery?
Yeah. Sad celery.
Have you got anything that's sort of like a bitter green?
I often do, but I don't right now.
All right. Have you got sour cream or anything like that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Great. A little sour cream. This is what we are going to do, all right? You're going to take a little bit of that bacon.
No, by the way, Lynn already knows she's won. I can hear it in your voice.
No, this is a victory lap.
This isn't a contest. You're done.
I have been known to mess up even in my most confident
moments.
You're
gloating already. All right, good.
Okay, we're gonna wash those leeks, get rid of all the sand, you know, in the layers, and you're going to thin slice them, just the lighter part, not the green part,
right.
Okay? Put that chicken broth into a pot, and you want about, how much have you got of it?
That's the problem. It's not a lot. 2 cups?
Oh, we don't have a... Lynn may be blown out of the water.
Oh, I forgot to mention that.
Okay, Jim, we'll just go to the omelet.
I will not give up. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to take that chicken broth and we're going to boil it down to about a half a cup.
Okay.
All right, you're going to concentrate it like crazy. And then what you are going to do is saute the leeks with a bit of the bacon until they're aromatic, and some thin sliced carrots and some thin sliced celery and celery leaves.
Oh, great.
You're going to just do a saute. You still want things to be a little bit on the crisp side, but you want a tad of brown edge. So you're going to need fairly high heat.
Are we going to frittata here?
No, we are not. You see, obvious. That's the
obvious. Oh, okay.
What we want to do is use a fair amount of those vegetables so we have a bed of vegetables. Then you're going to take some butter or olive oil, whatever fat you have. You're going to take a shallow baking dish, not a very large one, and you're going to smear or rub that baking dish with that fat, and you're going to spread the vegetables over that.
Oh, that sounds great.
Okay. Now you're going to shred.
And then you're going to go out to dinner.
You are so negative. I swear,
Kimbo. I'm so depressed we're not heading towards frittata. Okay, go ahead. I'll shut up.
It's so obvious. We're doing the unusual here. All right. Now, shred some of that delicious Colby cheese. Mix it with the sour cream. Add a little salt and pepper if you think it's necessary. And you are going to spread that over the vegetables so that you cover them by about 2/3. So it's like a pillow. And you're going to break 2 eggs over that. You're going to cover this with foil, put it in a 350-degree oven. I'm sorry, you're going to also have poured around the edges so you moisten the vegetables, the half cup of stock. And you are going to slowly cook that until the eggs firm up.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
And
I'm impressed.
The cheese is going to melt into those veggies, and you're going to get sort of a main dish gratin.
That sounds great.
That's okay. I'm stunned.
Yeah.
I'm stunned. Man, I knew it was a victory lap. You had me going. That was good.
Thank you for playing Stump the Carl.
Thanks, Leah.
That was fun.
Hey, you take care.
You too. Thanks so much.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Oh, I hate to go.
The pillow thing was very poetic, too, I thought.
Thank you very much, sir.
A great pleasure.
Our guest celebrity stump master is Christopher Kimball, editor and publisher of Cooks Illustrated and host of PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Now, to play Stump the Cook, call or email five things in your refrigerator, and one of our canny producers may call you to be on the air. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Joey Adams. He said, if it weren't for the fact that the TV set and the refrigerator are so far apart, some of us wouldn't get any exercise at all. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle. Palm Wonderful, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Now, you'll find information on almost everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And hold on, there is so much more on that website. Not only will you find newsletters and podcasts, you can get information on our book, How to Eat Supper, inspired by this very show, and you can find our collection of inexpensive recipes to get you cooking in your kitchen. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. A big welcome to our new listeners on WNYC FM 93.9. Look forward to hearing from you guys. Have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.